It takes time, Vasily, she whispered back to him. Please don't rush me. He smiled and took her hand and kissed it like a cavalier of old, then walked away. As she opened the unlocked cabin door, Lucita began to wonder if the calculations she saw in his eyes concerned her or something else. Teresa lay sprawled on the floor of the cabin, her skirt torn from her body, her blouse bunched up at her shoulders. There was blood on her bare thighs, bruises across her naked torso. The imprint of a hand welted one bare breast. Shreds of pantyhose clung to her calves. Her eyes fluttered open. Lucita, she moaned. A scream caught in Lucita's throat. But she could not make a sound, horrified though she was. She dropped to her knees beside her young aunt. What happened? Teresa, what happened? They raped me. Mother of God, who did this? How could they? She lifted Teresa's head from the floor. One eye was swollen shut. Blood crusted her lips. The rest was a nightmare. She phoned Malik for help as Teresa mumbled her nearly incoherent story. Two young crewmen. She had taken dinner in the station's main galley. They had sat at the same table with her. They spoke no Spanish. Teresa spoke no Russian. She said nothing to them. She ate and returned to her cabin. They followed her and called after her as she hurried down the corridor. There was no lock on the door. They burst in. She tried to phone. She tried to fight them off. They beat her brutally and took turns raping her. Malik arrived, white-faced with rage. A doctor came, an officer in uniform. They tried to question Teresa, but she was shaking with terror and shame now. The officer was some sort of policeman. He and Malik conversed in low, urgent voices, and he left. Lucita and the doctor helped Teresa to her bed. The doctor gave her an injection to make her sleep. We'll find the men who did this, Malik said, his eyes glinting like the steel blade of a knife. I promise you, they will be found and punished. After all the men left, Lucita sat up in her bed next to Teresa's and watched the sleeping young woman. She did not move, barely breathed. Lucita drowsed, her head slumping down to her chest, her eyes too heavy to keep open. When she awoke, Teresa's rumpled bed was empty. Startled, Lucita jumped to her feet. She saw that the light in the cubbyhole of the bathroom was on. Teresa was huddled in the shower stall, both wrists slashed open, her agonized face staring sightlessly up at Lucita, her life's blood already turning brown and crusty as it seeped down the shower drain. The cable car broke out of the gray mist and bright Venezuelan sunshine flooded in through the big windows. Lucita squeezed her eyes shut and the vision of Teresa's dead body melted away like the drops of condensed moisture on the glass before her. She took a deep, shuddering breath and brought herself back to the world of today. The car glided to a stop in its terminal at the foot of the mountain and its pneumatic doors slid open. The eight other people aboard shuffled out slowly, almost silently. Lucita was the last to leave. And standing there on the concrete platform waiting for her was the tall, blonde figure of Vasily Malik. Somehow she was not surprised. Lucita knew that there was no place on earth or even beyond it where she could hide from this man. He was wearing a military uniform of tan with red trim at the collar. It made him look more handsome than ever. A dozen yards away, two men in dark civilian suits stood watching. Bodyguards for Vasily, Lucita wondered, or jailers for me. Lucita. He reached out a hand toward her, tentatively. Hello, Vasily. She decided not to ask him how he had found her there. The black car following her on the highway had been Russian, not police. They had followed her to the cable car terminal, and Vasily had helicoptered to the other end of the line, obviously. You left Kosmograd before we had a chance to apprehend those who... I brought my aunt's body back to her home. We buried her last week. I never got the chance to tell you how sorry I am, how much I regret that this happened. I'm sure you do, Vasily. People were making their way across the platform to enter the waiting cable car. Malik put out his arm to guide Lucita back toward the rear of the platform where the steps led down to the parking lot. She moved before his hand could touch her. He let his arm drop and walked alongside her. We caught the two men responsible. A pair of Ukrainian mechanics. He said it as if he were describing noisome vermin. They were drunk, and they thought that your aunt was... Well, they made the mistake of their lives. Are they still alive? Lucita asked coldly. Malik said, yes, but they both wish otherwise by now, I'm sure. I had them sent to the lunar mines, hard labor. They'll never see the Earth again. As they stepped out of the cool shade of the concrete roof terminal and into the burning noontime sun, Malik said, I hope that this terrible tragedy doesn't come between us, Lucita. I hope you don't blame me for what happened. She looked up at him as they walked down the concrete steps and saw that he was very grave, very sincere. No, Vasily. I know it wasn't your fault. It was mine. That's not possible. As she spoke the words, Lucita realized that they were true. It was my fault. All my fault. I dragged Teresa around the world with me. I left her alone that night. I fell asleep when I should have been watching over her. I killed her. He stopped in the middle of the long stairway and turned to her. You mustn't think that. The victim is not responsible for the crime. It was the fault of two drunken louts, and they are paying for their outrage. And I must pay also, Lucita told herself. I must stop running away from my responsibilities. I must become an adult and accept the duties that have fallen to me. There is no escaping it. I will marry this man whether I love him or not, whether he loves me or not. There is no escaping it. Chapter 19. For more than 2 months, Dan went through the motions of leading a normal life. Normal for him. He worked at his office in Caracas. He visited the launch center off the coast at least twice a week. He changed secretaries almost regularly. The joke around the office was that no secretary of Dan Randolph's lasted longer than her menstrual cycle. He traveled up to Nueva Venezuela regularly, but stayed at the space station only briefly each time before riding a slim, needle-shaped transfer craft over to the factory. A new module had been added to the orbital manufacturing facility, a smallish metal globe that was connected to the factory's control center by a jutting length of tube, which served as a corridor to connect the two. The new globe had nothing to do with the factory's operations. It was a control center, small and stripped down by comparison to the control centers the old NASA once operated at Houston and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, but immediately recognizable by its banks of video screen monitors manned by intense men and women with earphones and pin mics clamped to their heads. Hanging in midair, weightlessly, next to the mission controller, a big, athletic-looking Angolan named Njombe, Zach Freiberg looked almost like a fugitive from a nursery. But Freiberg put in more hours at the control center than anyone. He was the scientific leader of the asteroid mission. He was living aboard Nueva Venezuela and spending 18-hour days in the control center, following every move, every breath and heartbeat of Dolphin 1's 8-man crew. Dan would pop in for a few minutes, see that the spacecraft was coasting on schedule toward the chunk of rock floating through space, listen to the routine chatter between the crew and the mission controllers, and return to the space station to put in the semblance of ordinary business. If the Russians actually knew about the asteroid mission, they were not giving any hint of it. All Dan's intelligence probes and bribes had returned no information, no sign that the Russians were aware of what was going on. Freiberg would return to the space station every few days with a batch of videotapes, and at night he would play the edited highlights of the past day's communications for Dan behind the locked door of his quarters aboard Nueva Venezuela. All's well as can be expected, Carstairs reported on the mission's 40th day. Electrical power's down 6% from nominal. I've scheduled an EVA for tomorrow to check the solar panels. Might be a micrometeor cracked one of the cells, or maybe dust coating them. His Australian accent said, might be. The voice of one of the mission controllers said, we copy the tail off in electrical power. EVA is approved. He said it over Carstairs, continued talking, because it took his laser-borne words slightly more than a full minute to reach the spacecraft, nearly 12 million miles away. Because of the time lag in communications, there were no conversations between the spacecraft and the control center. They had two nearly simultaneous monologues instead. The bloody toilet's acting up again, Carstairs was complaining, and all these years of batting about in space, you'd think somebody would come up with a zero-G toilet that actually works. and the air scrubbers are getting marginal.